Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I'm joined by Beau and I'm Josh. So what we're going to be talking about today are various aspects of psychology, things like how memories are formed, the nature of déjà vu, consciousness. Maybe we'll touch on some decision making and also some sex differences in facial emotion recognition, just as a bit of a narrative in how even the way you perceive the world is affected by your biological sex. But depending on the amount of time we have, we might not touch on those other ones, which I could turn into an entire Contemplations on their own. But we're definitely going to touch on the memory stuff, the déjà vu, and most likely the consciousness.
Well, cool. And I shall play the part of the rank amateur, picking the brain of someone who really knows their stuff. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, thank you. I mean, everyone's got some degree of knowledge of psychology, but you are a human being, and therefore you have life experiences that are relevant to the conversation, so no one's completely clueless. I feel like it's impossible to be an amateur psychologist unless you're like a child.
Right, okay.
So I think you're doing yourself a bit of a disservice there. But the kind of things that we're going to be talking about, for example, the weird sort of aspects of psychology, for example, a brain freeze is really a sphenopalatine ganglioneuralgia, which is quite a mouthful, isn't it? But yes, that's what that is pain occurring when the cold hits the receptors in the outer covering of the brain called meninges, and the cold creates a dilation and contraction of the arteries causing rapid onset headache. So that's more of a physiological thing really than psychology, but something that is definitely psychology is that the human brain can generate about 23 watts of power, which is enough to power a light bulb.
So it sounds like relatively quite a lot.
Yeah, well, there's a lot going on up there. Mm. Obviously, it's spread out quite disparately. The wattage isn't 23 watts just concentrated in one small area.
Right, right.
And there's also the point as well that piece of brain tissue the size of a grain of sand contains 100,000 neurons and a billion synapses, which is...
Can't really get your head around that.
I know, it's... But that gives you a sense of scale, just how many connections there are in your brain, because, of course, many, many grains of sand are making up your brain, so...
That's fantastically complicated. We said in another one when we were talking about space and things.
Yeah.
That... In the whole cosmos, it seems like the human brain is one of the most complex things.
This is what, whenever people who were studying other sciences were just like, oh, psychology is not a science. I'm just like, yeah, well, the human brain is the most complex thing in the universe. So actually, you're studying something far less complicated than me. Thank you very much. But no, you are right that as far as we know, it's the most complicated structure in the known universe, which is quite something. So we're not going to necessarily have conclusive answers about everything, but on things like memory, for example, we know how it works, and we have a good understanding of it. So let's actually have a look at what memory is. And obviously, we all know what memory does in our daily lives. You don't need that explained to you, but a more specific psychological definition of memory is that memory is the capacity to store and retrieve information. And that's really all you need to define it as. So
I find it interesting, I don't know if you're going to touch upon this, probably will, but the idea that quite a lot of your memories, certainly older memories, they're really sort of a memory of a memory, you know, that you've recalled it multiple times in your life. Perhaps you've got a particularly cherished very, very early childhood memory, and I feel like where I've recalled it multiple times over my life, it's now like you remember when you used to years ago, you would make copies of VHS tapes.
Of course.
And it would get really quite obviously worse the more you did it. But it's sort of the same with those memories in some way, that it's, I know that it's been corrupted in my own mind. It's not really the real memory anymore. If you can even have a real memory, what does that even mean?
You're touching on an important aspect of memory here. So we can break down memory into two different aspects, short-term memory and long-term memory. And these two aspects of memory use different areas of the brain, different neural pathways, that sort of thing.
Right.
So they're quite separate. And long-term memory you could describe as having an infinite capacity and duration. So once you experience something and it goes into your long-term memory, you're never going to lose it again. And that sounds weird because you think, well, surely if you forget something, you know, you forget you did something, well, then surely that's gone from your memory, right? If you can't remember it, well, it's not in your long-term memory. Well, it's not entirely true. Actually, the problem there is your problem with recall.
Right.
And quite often when people forget something that's in their long-term memory, it's that they can't recall it as easily rather than it's gone from their memory. Mm. So
just quickly to say on that, so I've heard someone say once, I can't remember who, but an actual expert in it, that every single tiny piece of stimulus you get in, everything you ever saw or said or heard, everything is stored in there. And it's just a case of recall. Most people can only recall a tiny, tiny fraction of that. So is that the case, that literally everything you ever saw or heard?
Well, I don't think it's quite to that degree in that, you know, you're not going to remember, oh, at, I don't know, 11:59 on this specific date, there was this specific noise. Right. Like it's got to at least capture your attention and be rank ordered in priority, whether it's worth remembering. There are lots of different ways, which we're going to get onto in a second, why specific memories might be remembered over others. But in theory, if particularly for memorable experiences, they will still stay up there, especially if they're emotive, which I'll touch on later.
Right,
but
right.
As I was saying, our problem is with recall. So I can use an example to kind of clear it up a little bit if you want. So there was a place I went to a few years back where I'd only been there as a small child and I had no memory of the place. I couldn't remember actually going there as a child, but I had this sort of feeling of familiarity. Places were in the same places that seemed about right from my recollection. And I could almost, the familiarity was the driving feeling rather than the memory. I couldn't recall the memory, but I had the familiarity. And I feel like this is a key aspect of it. And they're actually separate parts of your brain that recognize familiar things and recall the relevant information. And therefore, it's not just a matter of, okay, I've been to this place, I remember it, and therefore I can remember it perfectly again. It's all about being in the specific state of mind to recall the information as well. So if you're in the same emotional state that you were at the time that the memory was formed, it actually becomes a lot easier to recall it. And you could just have one thing or another. For example, I find that smell in particular is very good at jogging your memory, and there's and there's a theory of that because when we were hunter-gatherers, you would smell your food before eating it, and it'd be really useful if you had this backlog of memory where if you smell something, you're like, okay, well, that was a bit poisonous, gave me an upset stomach, and therefore it has a clear survival advantage, whereas I would argue that sometimes our visual memory is not nearly as good as our smell, sometimes even our hearing.
I've got one example of that, can I quickly say?
Of course.
Such a strong feeling, it was mad. I'm the youngest of the siblings in my family, so there were no sort of babies in my household after me. And then when I was about 25 or so, my older brother had kids, my little nephew. And again, when I was about 25 or so, at some point, somehow, I smelt some pseudocream, you know, that's like for nappy rashes and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't smelt that smell that I could recall in adult life or at all, really. And for some reason, I smelt this pseudocream. And it was like an explosion in my mind of memory, but not really like visual memories, but just a feeling. It's hard to explain how powerful it was.
Mm.
It was almost like a revelation of things, like a wave of all different half memories and things from a smell.
Yeah.
It was one of the most powerful examples of that I've ever had in my whole life.
Yeah.
And it was through smell, not sight or hearing.
It happens quite a lot. And this sort of getting the right conditions for recollection, part of the reason why sometimes hypnosis works on people, where you lull them into a specific state and then they can access memories that they couldn't otherwise access. Of course, that's fraught with false memories and people saying they remember stuff that they don't because of the suggestibility of the state they're in, but it does still have some utility as a method, although I wouldn't put too much faith in it myself. But it's worth talking about short-term memory as well, quickly. So short-term memory is very different from long-term memory in that it has a very reduced capacity, and there's something in psychology which most psychology students would be able to tell you about, known as Miller's magic number, that short-term memory has a capacity of 7 plus or minus 2. Well, what does that mean? So 7 is the average, but the sort of standard deviation from that average is about 2. So you could have 5 or you could have 9.
And sorry, 5 or 9, what units of what are we talking about? Sorry.
Well, that's a good question because it's not entirely clear. So you have examples of, say, you have a phone number and you can remember, say, 7 digits, maybe even 9 of the numbers in a sequence, and you can get that right. Of course, your short-term memory, by the very name, suggests that it can only be stored there for a short period of time, between about 15 and 30 seconds. However, there are ways to actually keep more information in there, which is known as chunking. So if you break the phone number up into different segments and see each one as its own unique thing, you can almost, I don't want to really call it trick your short-term memory, but you can capitalize on the way your short-term memory is programmed into your brain and actually remember a lot more because it's 7 unique units of things.
Okay, could be anything sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
Yeah, so it could be words, for example. You could remember 7 words even though there are more than 7 letters. So that's a good example of being able to remember, say, a sentence over a string of digits, because the words are chunked together. You could remember 7 words rather than 7 letters, whereas the number is not broken down into something. But I suppose what you could do is break it into groups of 3, groups of 2, right, and that might make it easier to remember.
Yeah.
But I think long-term memory is quite often the most interesting, in my mind at least. But yes, it's also worth mentioning that how do things get from short-term memory to long-term memory? And all that is either repeated exposures, if you're kind of rote learning information, or if it's an event in your life, it's got to be something emotive. You don't really remember the mundane because there's no emotion priming it to go straight into the long-term memory. And I find that emotions are particularly good at getting things in your long-term memory. That's why things like embarrassing memories can be so pervasive because of the emotion you feel at the time. And whenever you feel, say, embarrassed, all of those memories bubble up to the surface again because you're in the same emotional state. And therefore, these things come to the forefront of your mind again, even though you're not necessarily directly trying to recall them.
Yeah, that's so definitely true. Are you ever sort of just laying in bed trying to get to sleep, or just sitting on the bus or the train doing absolutely nothing, and suddenly one of your most embarrassing moments just pops into your head for no apparent reason? Of course, there would be a reason, but to you, it doesn't seem to be a reason. You just suddenly recall, oh God, that was so embarrassing.
I know.
Why is that still haunting me? Or yeah, like you say, the emotive thing. I can remember from childhood, I was relatively well behaved, but of course, at least half a dozen times or something, my mum going absolutely mad at me. I don't remember at all what I did or anything, but I just remember her going mad and my, you know, reaction to it, you know, because that was sort of the emotional bit.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose they feel like they're imprinted in there forever, sort of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's definitely rings true, absolutely.
There's one thing that I've not been able to pin down. Maybe people have ideas in the comments, that sometimes I have a really vivid memory of something that is really mundane. Like just a section of time where I wasn't doing anything out of the ordinary, and I can just remember it really clearly for some reason, and it's just stuck in my memory even though there's no reason for it to be there really. I've not really been able to find a compelling explanation for that, although memory isn't necessarily my specialisation, although I have done a bit of cognitive psychology. So yeah, that's one thing that I would like to learn about a bit more, but unfortunately I've not been able to pin down what exactly that is yet.
Well, surprising, as we say, the brain is so complex that we, in many ways, our civilization is, you know, quite advanced in some ways. You know, we've sort of been able to unravel a lot of the mysteries of the universe and things. And it's interesting that the brain is still, I don't know about largely mysterious, but there's big things we just don't know still.
Oh, right? Loads, yeah.
It's just surprising that that's one of the corners of our knowledge, which is still fairly mm-hmm. dark. Well,
there are lots of different ways in which we could learn a lot more, even about areas that we do know about. Like, you can start to quantify, say, you can look at the presence of certain neurochemicals. What's the threshold for which memories all of a sudden start taking emotional significance, for example? And you can measure that in certain neurochemicals that influence it. I'm not going to try and muddy the water and go into jargon, but there's still lots to learn, even from the areas we do know a reasonable amount about. Yeah. Because psychology is quite a young science as far as they go. You've actually got a fair amount of progress to make in pretty much all of the areas. There's not really anything that's just like, yes, we've figured this out now. So I suppose it's promising. It's why I found it exciting and interesting, is that there are no answers, and therefore you can speculate, and it's fun putting the pieces together. I'm sure you're the same with sort of ancient history, that it's an incomplete picture, and therefore you get to prescribe your own answers to these questions.
Yeah, as long as you're careful to say, this is my opinion, or I think, mm-hmm. or it suggests, or maybe it's likely that, mm-hmm. rather than just, this is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm sure we'll get there, you know, as long as we don't nuke ourselves into oblivion. We've got thousands, maybe millions of years to go, so mm-hmm. yeah.
So one thing that's always very useful to tell you about the nature of a brain function, I find, is the area of the brain that it's located, because it tells you a little bit about how these functions interact with the rest of the brain as well. So I wanted to have a look at some of the brain areas implicated in memory, and they're mostly located in the temporal lobes, which are on screen here. So they're kind of on the sides of your brain here, perhaps above your ears. So that's where they are.
So can I ask you something about that then? Because this is one of the things that I find particularly interesting and difficult to grasp.
Mm-hmm.
So I've asked you about this before, sort of off camera and things, that the memories are sort of physically in your brain, in a sense, that the neurons themselves organize in mm-hmm. a certain pattern. And we're talking actually physically.
Yes.
And it just seems crazy to me. I'm prepared to accept it, of course. Mm-hmm. But it just, I don't know, because I asked you before, what is a memory? What is mm-hmm. it? Is it a physical thing? Because I said to you, is it not just like the electrical, it's more to do with electrical synapse mm-hmm. type activity? And you said, no, it's actually more the actual atoms in your brain. That's just fascinating to me.
Yeah, so I'm going to get onto the neuron side of thing once I've talked about the various brain areas. I'm going to start big and work down slowly.
Okay.
But just to answer you quickly, it's more about the structure. So when you're experiencing new things in the outside world, it changes the structure of your brain. Your brain's very neuroplastic is the term that you can use. It's constantly changing all the time, adapting to the environment around you, and that includes the structure of your brain. And that's more or less what memories are. It's these groups of associations. And if you access certain associations more, think of them as like a web, these associations that are all interconnected together with the various nodes. And as you experience certain things more often, or you access the memories more often,
right.
it's almost like it makes the pathways wider. That's not necessarily true at the neurological level, but just to kind of colloquialize it a little bit, it allows travel more easily. Think of it perhaps like, dirt roads or something like that. The more you go down them, the wider, the clearer they get, and the easier they are to travel through. Again, you don't access them for a while, they start to grow over a little bit.
That's a good analogy. I like that.
I just came up with it off the cuff. But it's similar in that way, although not necessarily at the physical side of things. Although it can actually be that the connections are stronger and more easy to see, like the significant ones, but I'm not going to get into that too much. But yes, the temporal lobe is the main area, and it sits behind the ears and is the second largest lobe and the most commonly associated with processing auditory information and encoding memory. And of course, auditory information is important because we have conversations, and it's quite useful to store the conversations in your long-term memory. So that's why there's that connection there, because we are a social animal, that it would be beneficial to remember the social interactions we've had. And therefore, having an association with auditory information as well as smell, as we touched on before, is very useful.
Yeah. Of course, the audio thing. One tiny example. One of the first songs I must have been able to hear, or remember hearing, rather, weird, is Rhinestone Cowboy by Glen Campbell. Right. And I didn't hear that again until I was sort of in my teenage years. For whatever reason, I did hear it. And again, it was a bit like the Sudocream thing. It was like a blast of memory. And I must have been, I don't know, 3 years old or something, before all my other memories in some way had kicked in, any sort of visual memories. It was older than that. So I must have been a toddler, really, hearing Rhinestone Cowboy. And then, again, it was a very, very, very powerful feeling, rehearing the song. It's sort of hard to explain how powerful it was. I guess most people out there have got a similar experience about different things like that. But
I remember one of my earliest memories is it was my second birthday, but I didn't understand that it was a birthday for me. So I remember trying to articulate to my mum at the time, well, what's going on here? Whose birthday is it? Not being able to articulate myself well enough so she didn't understand what I was saying. And then just told me to go on and just enjoy myself and stop asking questions. And I remember that really clearly. And even though that's not really that important, I remember the sort of thoughts I was having at the time as a two-year-old and being frustrated that I couldn't explain myself in a sufficient enough way that I could be understood.
That's really interesting. I wonder if we could just take a couple of minutes just to ask you about earliest memories.
Okay.
So, for example, I don't remember anything visually before maybe 5 years old. And you just said like 2 years old there. Mm. So to me, that's sort of kind of crazy. I just don't recall anything from before about five. But I knew someone else who once said they remembered being really kind of a baby, like a 1 year old or something. They remember their mum trying to soothe them as a proper baby.
It's one of those things where there's a massive variance in how well people can remember stuff. I think mine's relatively early, but not too extreme. Like, people can remember up to like 1 year old, which is a bit strange. But
yeah,
some people report having no memories up until the age of about 7 or 8 sometimes.
I've heard that, yeah. Do you think as you get older, like when you're in your 70s or 80s, you know, that baseline keeps creeping up? That your oldest memories, unless you make some sort of conscious effort to keep recalling them or something and making those pathways wider. If you don't do that, then by the time you're in your 80s, then yeah, you can't remember anything before you were like 10 years old or whatever. I don't know.
I don't think it necessarily shifts with your age. I think it's very specific to individual differences. So once you have that memory, of course, you don't lose it. It's just your ability to access it, isn't it?
I
find that it really depends on just the specific person, because I've spoken to people who are very intelligent but don't have access to their really early memories. I've spoken to people who aren't very switched on, but they remember being really young, really early. Right. So it's not like a matter of intelligence or anything like that. It's just some sort of weird quirk. It's almost like there must be some sort of genetic influence of it almost. I would imagine that these sorts of things, these brain structures that dictate how well you can remember these early memories, would probably be passed on.
Right.
However, we just don't know yet. As far as I'm aware, at least, I don't know all of the research ever, but at least in the mainstream of psychology, there's certainly no explanation for this.
It's interesting, like, how some people can remember pie to hundreds of places. Well, records absurd, isn't it? Thousands and thousands of places. We can remember playing cards, whole decks worth of playing cards in the sequence. And other people just not. Probably no matter how hard they try or whatever techniques they practice, would still not be capable of that. So, like, you're really kind of born, like, your genetics predetermine how well you might be able to do that. Yeah, that makes sense to me. Absolutely.
I think that it's also strange that your ability with memory doesn't necessarily reflect your abilities in lots of other areas as well. Right. Like someone can excel in memory and nothing else really, which is kind of unusual, psychologically speaking, because normally when you get better at certain cognitive processes, it's kind of like the rising tide that lifts all boats a little bit, not to the same extent as the main thing you're doing, but say you're learning to read, I don't know, Shakespearean kind of era English, the process of focusing on that will also foster skills which might be useful at, I don't know, reading algebra equations or something like that. I know that sounds a bit disparate and unusual, but there's still some common skills there of even just sitting down and reading something and understanding something that you're looking at. And therefore, normally people will have some sort of baseline level of, well, I've not focused on these things, but they're still relatively good because I've got exceptional skills at certain things. And therefore, it kind of improves the cognitive processes that use comparable skills.
Right.
But it's kind of its own unique thing, memory. So it's not tied into that.
Do you think there's something there where, you know, you get like genius savants,
mm-hmm.
That not always, of course, because there were some great examples where this isn't the case, but often someone that's able to memorize a whole phone book or something also is, I don't know if this autistic is the right word, but they've got deficiencies in other ways,
like
serious ones.
Mm-hmm.
There is an example. I think the guy that's got the world record for remembering pi, sort of thousands of places, he isn't that. He's completely normal in most other senses. He can have a normal conversation, like he went to Oxford and all that sort of thing. But quite often, if you've got that extreme recall, you're actually deficient in other things.
It's like that artist that went up in a helicopter and remembered all of New York.
Right.
He's pretty autistic.
Right.
But he can remember all of that skyline, which to me is just nuts that someone can do that. I was very impressed when I saw it. But obviously there's a deficit here, and this is part of the sort of neuroplasticity side of things that I was touching on before. So I can use the example of, this is quite a famous study, that neurologically London taxi drivers have a very large part of their brain for visuospatial navigation. Because they use it a lot, and therefore you can look at a scan of their brain and be like, oh, right, that's noticeable that you use that all the time. So you could, in theory, have a selection of brain scans, and you could pick out the London taxi driver from those just based on the part of the brain that's involved there.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.